Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Instagram propose des outils pour la famille qui permettent à vos proches de naviguer de façon raisonnable et en toute sécurité sur l'application. Quand les ados créent leur profil Instagram, les comptes privés par défaut garantissent que ce qu'ils publient n'est visible que par eux et les personnes qui les suivent. Choisir une limite quotidienne de temps aide votre ado à naviguer de façon raisonnable sur Instagram. Et paramétrer les outils de supervision ensemble vous offre une meilleure visibilité des comptes suivis par votre ado. Pour en savoir plus sur ces outils et en découvrir d'autres, rendez-vous sur instagram.com/outils pour la famille.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 11th of November, these are our main stories. Another harrowing day in northern Gaza, as Palestinian officials say three hospitals have been hit by strikes from the Israeli military, who believe they're being used by Hamas.
Our forces are operating around the area because Hamas has chosen to strategically position their terrorist capabilities in, under and around hospitals.
The French President Emmanuel Macron speaks to the BBC about the ongoing conflict.
De facto, these babies, these ladies, these old people are bombed and killed. There is no reason for that and no legitimacy. So we do urge Israel to stop. Now it's time for a ceasefire.
Also in this podcast, the White House says President Biden will meet the Chinese leader Xi Jinping next week to try and stabilize relations. And President Erdogan says he's prepared to change the Turkish constitution to end a judicial dispute. The hospitals of northern Gaza are facing an increasingly grave situation as Israeli forces press ahead with their offensive against Hamas. Explosions have been reported at or near several of them, and local officials say Israeli strikes have hit three. The director of the biggest hospital in the territory, Al Shifa, accused Israel of launching a war on hospitals. Dr. Marwan Abu Sada is a general surgeon there. He said the situation is desperate.
Here in Shifa, I'm hearing the shooting and bombardment everywhere around me. But our staff is still there and our patients still there and we are taking casualties. Today they bombarded some of our displaced people who were here in Shifa. At the school they were under attack and more than 15 people killed at that moment.
Nabal Fursak is the spokesperson for the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, who runs the Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City, which is surrounded by Israeli tanks and is completely cut off.
This is the third day we have completely lost connection with our colleagues at Al-Quds Hospital due to intense bombardments that is taking place in that area. This is also the fifth day Al-Quds Hospital has been isolated because all roads that lead to Al-Quds Hospital are closed. No one can reach Al-Quds Hospital. No one also can go out from Al-Quds Hospital. The situation there is catastrophic. Yesterday, with the rare communication, I got a call from one of our colleagues, and he told us that we are for 24 hours and we will be completely running out of fuel. That means the hospital will be forced to shut down completely all of its services.
Israel say the Al-Shifa hospital is being used by Hamas as a command center, something which the medics there have denied. A statement from the Israeli military says they do not fire on hospitals and they are very much aware of the sensitivity. But if they do see Hamas fighters firing from hospitals, they will kill them. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, a spokesman for the IDF, confirmed Israel's military presence near hospitals and urged civilians in the north of Gaza to move.
We've been encouraging people to go south to Wadi Gaza, precisely because we're not operating on the ground in Wadi Gaza, because Hamas's hub of operations is in Gaza City. And that's where their center of command and control, all of those capabilities exist. We are determined to dismantle and destroy Hamas as a governing authority and a terrorist entity in the Gaza Strip. They have to go.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, told me more about what's been happening in Gaza.
I think what we learned today is that as the Israeli forces get further into Gaza City, it is becoming harder and harder to have any real visibility on exactly what is happening. I mean, we know that the Israeli military is close to these hospitals, as you've heard from their spokesman, and we know that there are regular incidents in which significant numbers of people are being killed. We cannot say with any great certainty how this is happening. It is clear that there are gun battles going on in the vicinity of some of these hospitals. The Israelis are saying that Hamas are there and that they are using the hospitals as cover for their military activity. We cannot independently verify that, but I think it's reasonable to assume that Israeli forces would not be attacking a hospital full of civilians if it didn't think that there was some kind of military necessity. The problem is that because there are still so many civilians who may want now to get out, but perhaps can't, feel it's too dangerous to leave those premises, it is almost inevitable now that more and more people are being caught up in this campaign.
And how is the situation in Gaza's hospitals and around them being viewed by people where you are in Israel?
Well, the Israeli public is by and large still very supportive of what is going on. It certainly supports the military and shares the desire of the government to root out Hamas once and for all. No Israeli wants to be in a position that they were in on October the 7th. And a majority feel that the only way to make sure that that doesn't happen again is to destroy Hamas once and for all. That's not the same as saying that they are confident in their government or indeed in their prime minister, both of whom enjoy pretty low ratings at the moment. But I think there is a general understanding that the Israeli military is doing what it needs to do. And so for the time being, at least, it enjoys pretty widespread popular support. Whether this continues, the longer it goes on, is hard to know. The IDF apparently is saying tonight that they are preparing to expand into new areas and, according to one TV report, preparing for a war that will be a year long. That is a long time to stretch anyone's patience.
Paul Adams. The BBC has been following the lives of five people inside Gaza as they face almost daily bombardment. They've been recording diaries, and these are their stories. In our second report, Hebar Bitar speaks to Farida Adel Al-Ghul, an English teacher who fled the north of the Strip before deciding the south was no safer.
I don't know if this is the last record I'm going to make or not, but this is Farida Adel. I'm located in the center of Gaza.
The very first message Farida sent to the BBC 4 weeks ago.
Several of my friends locally are now missing, possibly dead. I don't know.
Even at that point, life had become desperate, surrounded by devastation.
Three of my neighbors' homes were destroyed this morning by Israeli bombs, and we are all having to evacuate our homes. There is no electricity, food, water also are running out.
Before the conflict, Farida was an English teacher, having studied at the Al-Azhar University in Gaza City. Within a week, she left her home for the south with her brother and sister.
We are leaving now Gaza to other side because Israel calling us to empty Gaza now.
Israel education are targeting a lot of the streets, homes, and mosques around us. The case now is very horrible.
Without any transport, Farida was walking south for days.
I'm so devastated and exhausted. I ran out of words. I'm so frightened of what's happening now around me. A lot of bombing around us and all the children are crying. We don't know where can we go.
A journey that was supposed to take Farida away from the fear she had in her home ended with nowhere to call a home.
We went to the UNRWA schools. We don't have any free places there. We went to the hospitals also. We don't have any place just to sit. Israel occupation, make bombs in everywhere in Gaza. We don't have any safe places there. Because of that, we back to home just to save our dignity and to have a place to sleep.
Walking south for a few days turned into walking south, then north, back again to Gaza City.
I'm still alive, but not okay, because still Israel bombing everything around us.
The bombs are very hard. They cut off everything on Gazans to deny us from the rest of the world and let us just die. Even though the injured people, they are dead, they cut the whole electricity on Gazans, even though the hospitals and streets, schools, everything.
Farida remains in Gaza City, surrounded by the rubble of her former life, unable to seek refuge in the south, unable to escape a constant flow of missiles striking the family she once had.
I've lost most of my family, more than 18 members of my family. I'm thinking about nowadays when now we will die. No one will know about our dying or what's happening now.
Farida Adel Al-Ghul on life in war-torn Gaza. The US and China have confirmed that their leaders, Joe Biden and Xi Jinping, will meet next week in the San Francisco Bay Area. The summit will take place on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference. It will be their second face-to-face meeting during the Biden presidency and follows a sharp deterioration in relations earlier this year. From Washington, here's Barbara Platt-Usher.
The summit is important, but the goals are modest. To manage the relationship by ensuring communication channels are open, said a U.S. official. Especially those between the two militaries. China cut them off after then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan in 2022. The Biden administration has pressed to restore them. It points in particular to the diplomatic crisis that erupted when it shot down an alleged Chinese spy balloon earlier this year after Beijing refused to pick up the phone. Taiwan will be on the agenda, along with a host of other long-standing international and regional issues.
Barbara Platt-Usher. The Pacific island nation of Tuvalu is facing an uncertain future because of global warming. It's predicted that because of rising sea levels, the entire archipelago will be uninhabitable within the next 80 years. Two of the nine coral islands have already largely disappeared. To safeguard their future, citizens of Tuvalu are being offered sanctuary in Australia. Anthony Albanese, the Australian Prime Minister, said that his country had signed a landmark deal.
The treaty covers three main areas of cooperation: climate change, human mobility, and security. Australia commits to provide assistance to Tuvalu in response to a major natural disaster, to a health pandemic, or to military aggression.
Alex Ridson heard more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
On the face of it, it seems a pretty modest scheme rather than a mass climate resettlement project. 280 people from Tuvalu will be allowed to live, work and study in Australia each year. This is out of a population of around 11,000 people. And we understand, though, that this is the first time the authorities in Canberra are offering some residents facing displacement due to global warming the opportunity to resettle in Australia, although the numbers, as we say, are relatively small. The government in Tuvalu is warning that global warming poses an existential threat swallowed by the mighty Pacific Ocean.
So some financial supporters, well, for reinforcements.
Yes, Australia is boosting its commitment to help Tuvalu try to stave off the worst effects of climate change and sea level rises. Canberra is to spend another $10 million US dollars to help Tuvalu reclaim land from the sea and boost coastal defences. But as you say, there are dire forecasts that the entire South Pacific archipelago could be uninhabitable because of global warming by the end of this century.
And this is being seen by some as an attempt by Australia to compensate for its reliance on coal and gas, which is hugely controversial in the Pacific.
Well, yes, in many ways, Australia has been regarded as a sort of a climate villain, if you like, in the neighbourhood in the past because of its reliance economically on fossil fuels. But I think there's a very significant geopolitical element to this as well. This is an attempt by Australia to counter China's growing influence in the region. Australia has regarded the Pacific traditionally as its sphere of influence. Tuvalu recognizes recognises Taiwan, and like most other Pacific countries who have formal diplomatic relations with China, and as we say, Australia increasingly wary of Beijing's ambitions in the region.
Phil Mercer. Still to come in the Global News podcast, the BBC investigates why so many people died in their cars trying to flee a fire in the Hawaiian town of Lahaina.
Once I saw the roadblock, those people are on the road not because of a traffic jam, but because of one that's created by our authorities. It's criminal what happened. People lost their lives.
The UN Refugee Agency says it's gravely concerned about increasing fighting in Sudan's Darfur region between government troops and the paramilitary RSF. The UNHCR says the RSF and its militia allies have killed more than 800 people in recent clashes. One local civic group says the figure is even higher. I got more from our correspondent in the region, Kalkadan Yibatel.
Well, it seems that the latest fighting is concentrated in western Darfur, and we are hearing reports of atrocities, a large number of people being killed, and civilians are fleeing the area in thousands, crossing borders to neighbouring Chad.
And those who cross the border into Chad are telling the aid agencies some fairly horrifying things.
Absolutely. This area has been, you know, at the centre of reports and accusations of ethnic targeted attacks, particularly against non-Arab tribes living in those areas. Rights groups as well as witnesses have been accusing the RSF as well as its allied Arab militias of targeting these non-Arab communities and subjecting them to horrific violations, arbitrary killings, as well as sexual violence and similar abuses. So that's what we're hearing. The UN said that it's deeply alarmed by the recent developments. And it seems that this conflict and its resulting humanitarian crisis is not getting enough attention as the world is distracted by other pressing crises across the globe.
And is either side gaining the upper hand in this conflict?
Well, for the first few months of the conflict, it seems that the fighting was rather balanced, particularly around the country's capital, Khartoum, as well as in this western Darfur area. But in recent weeks, we are seeing that the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, this paramilitary group is gaining momentum. It's capturing a number of military bases, as well as important cities and the strategic areas. But with its advances, these horrific reports are emerging.
Kalkadan Yubatal in Addis Ababa. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, says he's prepared to change the constitution to end a dispute between the country's highest courts. He's criticised Turkey's constitutional court at a time when its authority is being challenged by the country's top appeals court, a move experts say is unprecedented. Danny Eberhard has the details.
President Erdogan has described himself as a referee in the standoff between Turkey's two highest courts. But critics fear he won't be an honest broker, having long accused him of politicising the judiciary. This dispute centres on a case involving a lawyer, Can Atalay, jailed last year for his role in major protests against Mr. Erdogan's government a decade ago. He was subsequently elected to parliament. Because of this, the Constitutional Court recently ruled he should be released. The Supreme Appeals Court has not implemented the ruling and has countered by filing a criminal complaint against the Constitutional Court judges who made it. Mr. Erdogan appears to side with the Appeals Court. He's criticised the Constitutional Court, alleging it's made many mistakes, and he raised the prospect of further constitutional change.
We don't look at the latest dispute from the perspective of who is right or who is wrong, but what needs to be done to solve this issue. When we look at it from this angle, we see the necessity for our country to obtain a new constitution as soon as possible.
The appeal court's move has sparked demonstrations by Turkey's main opposition party and members of the legal profession. Hundreds of lawyers marched to its premises in Ankara, chanting for justice. They place copies of the constitution on the fence surrounding the court in protest. This doctor of constitutional law, Serkan Koybaşı, explained the seriousness of the situation.
You might not like the Constitutional Court's decision. You can criticize it, but saying I'm not implementing this means not accepting the supremacy of the Constitutional Court and the Constitution in this country. This would mean suspending the Constitution. When you suspend the Constitution, you are suspending the state. You are suspending the judicial system.
How the crisis is resolved and what this means for judicial independence and the separation of powers will be scrutinised not just in Turkey, but abroad too.
Danny Eberhard. A fire in August destroyed most of the historic Hawaiian town of Lahaina, which cost the lives of nearly 100 people. Many of the dead were killed in their cars as they tried to escape. How could a fire next to the ocean turn so deadly? The BBC's James Clayton has been to Hawaii to investigate what happened that day.
The wind that day was intense when a fire began to the east of the Hawaiian town of Lahaina. U'i Kahu'e was watching the wind rip through her home and tear off her neighbour's roof.
He saw the grey smoke, and within minutes it turned into this big, black, ugly smoke.
U'i decides she has to flee by car, but she's met by a huge traffic jam. She sees smoke engulfing cars.
In my rear view, I can see headlights disappear into the black smoke. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, we're not moving fast enough. We got to get out of here. There's people back there. It just went on until it disappeared.
Many people had to abandon their vehicles and enter the sea to survive.
Everybody's got to evacuate. Evacuate now!
The BBC has obtained police body cam footage that shows that even the police were exasperated about the traffic jams.
We gotta move these cars. Why are the cars not moving?
Why the traffic was moving so slowly is something we've tried to find out. For sure, some roads were blocked because of fallen debris, but other roads were blocked by the police due to downed power lines and a fear of electrocution. This is the chief of the police, John Pelletier, speaking a few days after the fire.
We did not close or forbid people from getting out of Lahaina. If there is a downed power line, we want to make sure that you didn't go over a downed live power line.
However, Hawaiian Electric, the local electricity provider, has told the BBC that the power lines were not energised during the fire and that it told the police numerous times throughout the day that they were de-energised. This is a recording of such a conversation given to the BBC.
Hawaiian Electric, Trouble Department.
Hi, Nico, Police Department. Fire is asking if you guys can shut down all of the electric off of Lahaina Luna, above and below the bypass.
It's off right now.
It's all off?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye.
The police, however, have told the BBC that the company did not give clear and definitive confirmation that the lines were de-energised. The result was the police treating lines as live and blocking roads. One witness, Travis Miller, showed the BBC his footage he filmed of the main road going north out of the city blocked for hours by the police.
I knew, like, once I saw the roadblock, this is insane. Those people are on the road not because of a traffic jam, but because of one that's created by our authorities. I feel like it's criminal what happened. People lost their lives that wouldn't have lost their lives.
The mayor of Maui, Richard Bisson, told the BBC the town should have been better prepared.
That's what everybody is pointing to. Better response. Just a better awareness of the dangers we face.
And who should take responsibility for that?
We all should take responsibility.
At least 99 people lost their lives that day, and authorities are still trying to identify remains using DNA technology.
You can see more from James Clayton on the BBC News Channel on Saturday, Our World, Escape from Lahaina. The family of a young Japanese actor who apparently took her own life in September have been speaking out about her poor treatment and long hours while working for one of Japan's most popular entertainment companies. The Takarazuka Review is an all-female musical theatre troupe, with women often playing male roles. It's tough to get in, thousands apply, and this is from their show, A Second Fortuitous Meeting.
Come
So, what may have been the main complaints from the actor's family? I got the details from our reporter, Will Leonardo.
This is the tragic story of this 25-year-old actress. She's not being named. She was in her seventh year with the troupe. She was found dead in her apartment on the 30th of September by apparent suicide. Today, at a press conference, the lead family lawyer detailed accusations that paint a grim picture of a life of stress and bullying for this actress, really. He said that she'd recently taken on a role as a coordinator for junior members. She'd worked 250 hours overtime in a month, getting them ready for latest performances. So some nights they suggested she got maybe 3 hours sleep if she was lucky. And they also said that she'd been verbally and physically abused by her superiors. They'd been blaming her, according to this lawyer, for failings by those that she was meant to be looking after, so her juniors. And there was one incident where she was alleged to have been burnt on her forehead by a hair iron. The company denied this when it was reported a few weeks ago in a Japanese magazine, but it's being looked into again. And the family, they want an apology from the company and, they say, the bullying colleagues and financial damages. And it's worth noting that Takarazuka, the company, have said that they've taken on the statement and the family's concerns with sincerity and that an investigation is still ongoing.
How significant is this theatre troupe?
It's huge. It's a kind of uniquely Japanese theatre company. It draws tens of thousands of people to what's a relatively nondescript city in western Japan called Takarazuka. And they perform kind of western classics as well as Japanese folklore. It's huge ensemble casts, amazing music, you know, amazing costumes. But the key thing, all the performers are women, and that's very rare in the world. The actresses often live in their kind of adopted genders. They speak like men throughout the rehearsals, and Japanese is quite a gendered language, for example. It was founded in 1913. By a railway boss who wanted to bring customers to the end of one of his railway lines, which is Takarazuka, the city. Unsurprisingly, it's very popular among women and has been kind of lauded for that, but that's seen by some as a sort of finishing school. It's very competitive to get into, and once you're in, it's rigid and hierarchical. Suggested, for example, or reported, that first years are made to clean by hand the premises every day.
And there have been a number of scandals in the Japanese entertainment industry in recent years. Are Japanese people becoming more vocal in accentuating these concerns?
The key scandal that's been coming out over the past few months is this talent agency, Janis Associates, which was founded by Jani Kitagawa, who died a few years ago, but it turned out over the course of decades there'd been accusations building up against him of abuse towards minors. So there was a pall of silence around his activities until quite recently. And I feel like that has probably sparked a wider conversation about how talent are treated within Japan and whether that's actually good for the people who are involved.
Will Leonardo. Let's return to the ongoing conflict in Gaza. On Friday, Palestinian officials said Israeli strikes had hit three hospitals and a school in Gaza, killing more than 20 people. The International Red Cross has warned that hospitals in Gaza have reached a point of no return. An Israeli army spokesman has said that its soldiers do not fire on hospitals, but if they see Hamas militants shooting from them, they'll kill them. A spokesperson for the World Health Organization, Margaret Harris, told the BBC that attacks on healthcare facilities must stop.
We've documented over 100 attacks on healthcare, I should say. It's beyond hospitals, it's also ambulances, healthcare personnel. And 16 healthcare personnel have lost their lives while on duty, but 192 have lost their lives overall. And we've seen 100 UN aid workers lose their lives. We don't say who did what, but all I can say is this violence is causing massive loss of life. We've got to be able to do better than this. We must be able to stop.
The Israeli Defense Force says it has urged civilians to move away from the hospitals. Daniel Hagari, a spokesman for the Israeli military, says more than 100,000 Palestinians in Gaza have moved from the north to the south of the Strip in the past 2 days. The Hamas-run health authorities in Gaza now say more than 11,000 people have been killed in the Israeli offensive. On Thursday, the French President Emmanuel Macron hosted a conference in Paris aimed at coordinating aid for Gaza. On Friday, he spoke to our Europe editor Katia Adler about the ongoing conflict and the sentiments that were expressed at the conference.
I was one of the first leaders to call the Prime Minister and President of Israel after the terrorist attack. We clearly condemn this terrorist attack and this terrorist group and recognize the right of Israel to protect itself and react. But day one, we say that this reaction and the fight against terrorism, because it is led by a democracy, should be compliant with international rules, rule of war, and humanitarian international law. And day after day, what we saw is a permanent bombing of civilians in Gaza. We discussed about safe zones, about the south of Gaza. We discussed with Egypt and so on. And the clear conclusion of everybody during the humanitarian conference, from United Nations to NGOs to all the governments being present, is that there is no other solution than first a humanitarian pause going to a ceasefire, which will allow to take care of people being in hospitals and to protect babies, ladies, old people, all the civilians having nothing to deal with the terrorists.
Do you think Israel is respecting those rules, the international rules that you're referring to?
De facto is not the case, and I do regret it. And we do share their pain, and we do share their willingness to get rid of terrorism. We know what terrorism means in France. But I think there is no justification to attack civilians. There is no justification to make a distinction between the different lives. Palestinian lives do matter. This is why I do call for this immediate humanitarian pause and a rapid ceasefire, precisely to protect the civilians. We know the solution, the two-state approach. We know the different treaties and negotiations having decided such an approach. I mean, just it was not implemented. If you want them to condemn very clearly any type of violence, you have to demonstrate the fact that there is another way out than violence, which is precisely a political process. So security and fight against terrorism, humanitarian protection, and all lives matter, and a political process with a two-state solution. This is how I see.
Are you saying that Israel is guilty of breaking international humanitarian law?
I think it's not the proper way to approach the question. We do recognize their right to protect themselves. We do contest the fact that the better way to protect itself is having a large bombing of Gaza. We are ready to cooperate, to help in order to fight against terror. But we do urge them to stop this bombing. De facto, today, civilians are bombed. De facto, these babies, these ladies, these old people are bombed and killed. There is no reason for that and no legitimacy. So we do urge Israel to stop. I'm not a judge. I'm a head of state. I think now it's time for a ceasefire.
French President Emmanuel Macron speaking to Katia Adler. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast at the same time tomorrow. But later on Saturday, you can hear The Happy Pod, a selection of our favourite positive news stories with Harry Bly.
Yes, we've got a common theme in this episode, birds. We'll meet the biologist who's dedicated his life to protecting penguins in South America and beyond, a woman in Mexico who's given her time and her home to hummingbirds, and the world's oldest chicken called Peanut, uplifting news from around the world in this podcast feed every Saturday.
This edition was mixed by Mike Campbell. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.